And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Well, this is D.G. Martin. Welcome to Who's Talking, and I've got the special privilege of joining President William Friday in his offices in Graham Memorial to just have a chat. I've got the feeling, President Friday, that you aren't all this excited about celebrating or marking the 90th birthday, but there is sure a whirlwind of activity that seems to be developing. It's like the weather report said there's a hurricane coming.
Well, I don't mean to be the source of such a thing, D.G. Birthdays come and birthdays go. I just realize I'm getting older, and you can come to work as I did this morning, and I do several days a week, and approaching 90th birthday. But so what? That's what I've done all my life, and it keeps me going. It's the energy, in part, of my life, because I'm so involved with what is happening around that. If I can nudge it a little bit more forward, then that's what I'm here for.
Well, you know, 90 to me doesn't seem as old as it used to be. It seems like just, when I had my 70th birthday, one of my friends called and said, D.G., don't worry. 70 is the new 69, and so maybe 90 is the new 89.
Well, I just got a nice letter from Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, and he said, I understand you're turning 90. He said, having reached 93, I want to tell you life goes on, Bill. Well, I had my blessing from Notre Dame, but I think that's a part of it, is having great, good friends like you and Father Ted and so many others that have been wonderful to Ida and me. But D.G., getting to be 90, you look back a lot on things that you did do and didn't do. But one thing is abundantly clear. Whatever success anybody claims, it's not individual. The privilege I've had as being a part of a wonderful team of people, including you, all of us had the same dedication. That was to make the University of North Carolina the finest institution we could make it. And to be a part of that is the rewarding part of this 90-year business. You know, every day is different. Every day is interesting. Every day is a new face. And that's why you get so stimulated working in an institution like this. But let's be very clear. This has been a team undertaking. It always will be a team undertaking. And Ida and I are just grateful we had a chance to be a part of it.
Well, I think all of us are mighty grateful that that Friday family team was put to work on behalf of all of us and leading us. And as you say, the team is the critical part of success. You know, we're celebrating ability to say things tactfully as you do, but I mean, we're sort of celebrating your old age and the fact that we've got your wisdom and presence and reminders of the past challenges and successes. But I'm old enough to remember that the most remarkable thing about William Friday was that at a very young age, he was thrust into the university leadership positions. And I wondered, does it strike you as kind of ironic that we're celebrating William Friday as the older sage, whereas 50 years ago, we were in the early 1950s, we were celebrating this bright young figure in higher education?
Well, one thing, D.G., it's been a long journey and a changing journey. Back then, those in the 50s, I remember so well the day Governor Hodges asked me to come, and I went to the Capitol and met with the executive committee, and I had been Gordon Gray's assistant for 5 years, and I knew a lot about what was going on in the president's office, and Dr. Perks had gone to take another position, and Billy Carmichael had been acting president. He said he didn't want to be again, and Gordon Gray, of course, had gone back to Washington, so I was the only one left with Buster Shepherd, so they put me into the acting capacity then, those days. But then the day came, and we were talking about the presidency, and I knew so much, and I knew that there were so many stressful things, that it was frightening. It was not a moment of exhilaration, I assure you. And I walked out of the Capitol, and I got down there to the Worth Bagley Monument, and I turned around, and I walked back to the Capitol building, and I started to open the big door to go back in there and say, look, this is not something that I can do. But somehow I just had a second thought. I said, well, this is really none of my business. I'd better be content with the interview I've had and go on home. And I did. And I was out at the state campus, and they sent for me to come back down there. And that's when they asked me to do what I've been doing. But it was a very trying time, because we were having all kinds of problems, and the budgets weren't what they should be, and it was stressful. And I knew what I knew, at least I thought I knew what we were getting into. But once you move from sitting out here to moving to the chair, it's different.
Yeah, you mentioned that when you took over as the president, or as the acting president, you knew what you were getting into, because you had been, I don't want to say the backup, but you had been managing some of these developing crises. One of the ones that I don't think we've talked about as much as we might in terms of leadership challenges is the situation you faced immediately at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, or at Women's College. It was in the process. I can't remember what it was being called at that moment, but name changes was also a challenge during those times. And it was made doubly difficult because the lead man over at Greensboro was the son of one of Chapel Hill's beloved heroes. And I've always wished that you would bare your soul about this, and maybe enough water's gone under the bridge now that we can talk about it, as it must have been a terrible strain for you.
That is putting it mildly. It was a very difficult time, because Ed Graham was a very personable person. He'd come here from having been assistant to the president at Cornell, where he did a very good job. And President Gray put him in office, and we were all celebrating him. And somehow, it just didn't work. Ed was he's a very quick on the trigger kind of personality, but a wonderful young person. And troubles began. He was not as patient as he possibly could have been, and tensions developed on campus. And the next thing that I knew, the trustees were at their own investigative committee, and Mr. Robert Haynes of Wachovia was the chairman of it. And when I was asked to take over, I had to say, well, Mr. Graham reports to the president. He doesn't report to the trustees directly. And so it's my job first. And I sat down with Ed and worked back and forth and back and forth. And finally he decided on his own that it was time for him to move on. And I never will forget that experience. The meeting took place in Girard Hall, and he announced his resignation there. And we walked out of the building together, and I put my arm around him, and somebody took that picture. And Paul Green tore it out of the paper and sent it to me and said, what a tragedy, what a tragedy. And he meant that in the best sense of the word. Not easy, because I was very aware of Ed Graham's place in the history of this institution. And I'm sure he had aspirations to be president someday. But it was the best word is just tragic, D.G. That's what it was.
Well, your description of Ed Graham's strengths and weaknesses reminds me of the challenges that the president of the university faced faced and still faces in terms of dealing with the chancellors of the different institutions and the different leadership styles that are required to manage a campus and to do it in the context of the system. You have said in a nice way that he might have been too decisive and too quick on the trigger. And when you look for leaders of the different institutions that are part of the University of North Carolina, you do look for decisiveness, don't you? And how do you keep the decisiveness from overriding the wisdom and politics of it all?
Well, in the first place, anybody you're interviewing to be a chancellor has to read the code of the university, because it's very precise and carefully written, because it is not a coordinating board. It is a functioning governing board. That is the very clear difference. It's the way the University of California operates, University of Michigan, the University of Wisconsin, and Texas that I know of. Because there was a time when I and my counterparts would meet together. There were 10 or 12 of us, and those were great, very powerful days when you sit down with Clark Kerr and Robin Fleming of Michigan and Connie Elvium from Wisconsin and Mickey LeMater from Texas. You were dealing with a lot of power there. And the idea is, if the individual understands the relationships that in this state is a matter of law, it's not optional, then you make work very harmoniously. But we had the advantage of taking expansion in North Carolina a step at a time. First Charlotte, then Asheville, Wilmington, and then all of a sudden, all the rest.
Let me interrupt you just because I wanted, I tell you what, let's take a quick break and then come back to that. I'm visiting with President William Friday, and his offices sort of centered around the celebration of his 90th birthday. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is President William Friday, and we're just going all over the last 90 years. And I've chosen to try to engage President Friday with some of the early leadership challenges that he faced. And one of them that you were describing, as I interrupted you before the break, was the addition of three campuses to the consolidated university. And this was at a time when we had really no idea that we would ever be a 16 or a 17 campus system. But adding new campuses to the three campuses which had been in existence forever and had been joined for a significant amount of time under the leadership of this 100-member Board of Trustees, this is a challenge that hit you square in the face when you became president.
Well, all of us knew following World War II that we hoped that there would be hundreds of young people, returning veterans particularly, who had come to get advanced education. The university had to be ahead of that. There was a very wise man here who ran the Extension Division, who opened extension centers in Asheville, Wilmington, and Charlotte. And there was the genesis of what has happened. But it was very apparent that the largest city in the state, the largest concentration of power, and no institution. It was very unusual. And once the Charlotte power block got together, I knew what was going to happen. And Irwin Belk was in the state senate at the time, and he made that his sole effort. And it passed in the legislature with one dissenting vote, and that was Thomas Jackson White of Kinston, the chairman of the Advisory Budget Commission at the time. Didn't make it easy, but it was done. Well, the minute the university took Charlotte in, it was inevitable that the other two would come in time. It took a period of 4 years, 3 or 4 years, but I thought that they ought to be affiliated as colleges. I really did, and tried to get the trustees to see that. I'd seen it done in Michigan. I'd seen it done in other places, but they would have none of it.
What was your thinking about it, and then what was the counter on the part of those who thought it was a better idea to bring them in as sort of full-fledged partners?
My thinking was that it should take more time. They hadn't developed as a university campus. Now, that was the old-fashioned argument of if you say you're a university, be one and act like one. But you sensed, I'm sure, immediately following World War II, that every college around you changed its name to university. Well, you get caught in that flood tide, no argument prevails. And that's the way it was bound to happen. But the thing that we tried to do that was a control mechanism was that whatever the name, these are the standards you have to meet. These are the requirements that have to be in every degree program. These are the standards in choosing faculty. These are the standards in admissions policies. Those were made uniform to ensure quality. And I think that was a very important thing for the trustees and the board to do. Everybody knew where we stood. Everybody knew what the ground rules were. But I did one other thing. I asked the chancellors to meet with me, and I had a wonderful team of people around in my office, and we all sat down together one day, and we tried to clear the air. I said, now listen, everybody understands what the law requires, and everybody understands what the state requires, but let's work this out now this way. I will never go before the board with any major policy that I have not discussed with you prior to that decision, listening very carefully, taking into full account whatever your chancellor's feelings might be in the interest of your campus. On the other hand, I don't expect you to take an action that would be a complete surprise to my office. Therefore, we can have a harmonious working relationship and always work on the principle of advance notice. That sustained it, and I think ensured the growth that we experienced until I left in 1986.
Well, one of the things that I think is still controversial to this day that was one of your earliest leadership challenges had to do with university athletics. And in preparing to talk to you today, I did some background reading, and I didn't remember that your predecessor, Gordon Gray, also had strong feelings about the role of athletics in university life. And so looking for the sources of William Friday's feelings about the risk of overemphasizing athletics as a part of the university experience, I wondered if Gordon Gray had been your mentor in this.
Well, I went back before him to the experience Frank Graham had, where he tried his best to establish certain principles and was soundly defeated. And I made certain that President Gray understood and knew all about that. And then his day came, I think, really over the decision for Coach Tatum to come here. That's where the crisis occurred.
I just have to say that this is something that's not talked about very much or remembered very much. Would you tell us about what that difference of opinion was within the university community?
Well, I think President Gray saw in that decision the movement toward more big-time
sports. This is the movement at Chapel Hill to bring Jim Tatum back to the campus to take over the football team and make it a championship team.
That's exactly right. But every president in a public university today has the same problem. I don't care where he is or who he is. If he's acting as president, now if he just sort of sitting there, then he's not worried about it. But
Well, now, ultimately, the decision was made to hire Coach Tatum. Yeah. And so the voices of from the president's office were overwhelmed by the campus or the alumni or the athletic viewpoint.
And that controversy was unfortunately brought to an end promptly when Jim died of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. But that is the struggle that goes on even more vividly today. I had, at NC State, I hadn't been in office 3 months till I was met with the famous Jackie Moreland case, which resulted in the most dramatic sanction by the NCAA of NC State. And then came a series of cases. And then we had Frank McGuire's instance here. The reconciliation that's got to come, DG, now, is that intercollegiate sports has gotten outside the institution. The president they don't control it anymore. The days when Father Hesburgh and I started the Knight Commission, we felt there was real hope there to gain control and to do what is right. And in fact, that commission did a very good piece of work up to the time that commercial television brought the money. And money turned the heads of far too many people. And today, the Knight Commission's most recent report is saying that if you don't soon tend to this, it's going to collapse of its own weight. And I really believe that. You bring so much criticism on the university. Look at the current session of the legislature. All that you hear is, why was all this hostility there? Well, the answer was, look, you spent $70 million on a stadium. You spent $30 million doing this and that. You doing all these things. You don't need any money. Well, that's the negative way of looking at it, but that's the undercurrent. You see, that gets into it. That's where it becomes so critical.
Well, let me go back to the earlier times, where in one of the most courageous decisions I think that you made, or you led in making, was the termination of the Dixie Classic. And as I look back on that decision, it's hard for me to put myself in your shoes, but one of the things that you've taught me is that you don't want to unnecessarily destroy your support constituencies, but you sure did destroy, or at least you damaged, the constituency of university supporters, like in Eastern North Carolina, and particularly North Carolina State people who loved the Dixie Classic. And then there were, I can remember when my father took me all the way from David. He was a big basketball fan, took me all the way from Davidson just for one day at the Dixie Classic. It was a big event. So there were people all over North Carolina who were mad with you, and probably some still mad with you about it. Why did you feel like it was necessary to make that strong a statement in dealing with college athletics at that point?
I did it primarily, DG, after consultation with Chancellor Aycock and Chancellor Caldwell. We sort of locked ourselves in the same room for 2 days working on this problem. And you come back inevitably and directly to the issue that this athlete was taken outside the building and his life was threatened. And it was really, truly an episode of real threat. Well, any college administrator who faced with that doesn't see the very real danger in it, then he shouldn't be president. I felt in the end, once we talked it out, that there was no other option. You had to do something that would say to these people, look, you've already invaded the event, you've invaded the circumstance, you bring big money in here gambling. We've got to remove the cancer, and that's what we did.
We're visiting with President William Friday, all on the occasion of his 90th birthday. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting in the offices and Grand Memorial of President William Friday. And President Friday, as I look out the window, I'm so jealous of the view that you've got. Your chair doesn't face the outside. Do you ever turn around and just look outside and watch the kids go back and forth from Franklin Street up towards the old well?
Too often. I don't turn around and do any work. I'm enjoying the scenery, but... You remind me one day, DG, my phone rang, and the other end was Charlie Carroll. And he said, I was in South Building at the time. He said, walk over to the window. I said, why, Charles? And he said, walk over to the window. He said, look out there. He said, do you see any dogs? I said, yes, I see a flap-eared hound over there. And he said, now tell me, do you see any birds? I said, yeah, there are cardinals and robins out here this morning, all having a great time. I said, what's the matter? Are you homesick? And he said, you can't imagine how homesick I get for Chapel Hill. And that's what the beauty of this place says to people. And there was a soul that, whom I, you know, July 4th, that's the day he died, several years ago. And I remember that day so well when my phone rang at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was Charles' secretary telling me that he'd passed away. But she called me because she said the last letter he wrote was to you. And the letter he wrote was about a place to be buried, and said he was not the least bit conscious of thinking of dying. He said he just wanted to get a place. And one of the interesting facts of life is that the man who was his adversary in days when Charles was editor of the Daily Tar Heel was George Hogan. And George called up and said, I've got two spots for Charles' burial place. That's why he's in the Chapel Hill Cemetery.
Well, that sort of reminds me that one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was making friends out of enemies. And I had the occasion to visit with former Senator Robert Morgan the other day and talked about the folks that he admired the most. And he very honestly and sincerely said, you know, President Friday is one of my great heroes. And he mentioned others, Terry Sanford. These were people that he'd had big battles with, head-to-head. And with you over the East Carolina Medical School, the expansion of the university, the speaker ban law. And so how am I going to say this? But one of your great strengths was, I think, is if you held a grudge, you put it deep inside and went out and tried to bring didn't write people off. What's your philosophy about dealing with people who are your firm enemies on some political matters?
Well, D.G., holding a grudge hurts no one but you. I found that out long, long ago. Another circumstance is that my generation grew up in, we really knew what the Depression meant. We were old enough to suffer from it. And we were also the people that spent 4 years or more, if we were lucky enough to get home, in World War II. You develop a point of view from that kind of early year exposure that is quite different. You don't get upset by little things. I was looking at my class at NC State the other day. How many of the boys that I was with every single day were shot down in North Africa and all through Europe? And Bob Goldberg, a boy from Wilmington, a wonderful young man. He gets swept off the deck of a destroyer in a storm in the Northeast Sea and never seen again. You don't get upset by little things when you have that kind of in your background. You were conditioned differently. And you always, at least for me, I understood that I was doing things that irritated people. But I don't make those issues personal. These are progress questions. Do you add 4 campuses to the university? That's not Bill Friday's ambition. That's the movement of an institution. You have to try to learn that you can disassociate yourself from that, but not a lot of people don't. They didn't actually say sweet old Bill either, you know. You understand when you work in a place like this that the basic fundamental rule is that it has to be forward-looking. It has to be creative. It has to be innovative. Look at what the university has done on the life of the state of North Carolina. Over and over and over again, you see it in so many different manifestations. And this is why when you're in administration, those are the forces that have to guide you, the tradition of the place, the importance of it, the creativeness of it. You put that at work. And you bound. People don't like to change, D.G. You know, you get comfortable. And I'm one of the worst examples. But I know and knew that when you had people around you as able as I did, and I tried not to choose a single person who worked with me who wasn't better than I was at what he was doing. And that was the first rule with me. And he or she, and I picked some wonderful women to work in administration too. But that's what you have to do. You have to fit yourself into the spirit of the mechanism and the institution and the whole structure of where you find yourself. And if you don't, you'll be hopelessly lost.
We're visiting with President William Friday in his offices in Grand Memorial. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is President William Friday, and we're reminiscing a little bit. We have an excuse for doing that. We shouldn't wait till 90th birthdays to reflect on some of these great things. And I've been reflecting and trying to uncover as best I can the secrets of the successes that you and your team achieved. And one of the things I think that keeps coming back to me is that not all of you and your team's activities were successes, but that you correct me if I say this wrong, but you simply refused to accept defeats as defeats, but instead turn them to make the best of them. And the best example is your biographer, William Link, pointed out as I reviewed his wonderful book about you, was in connection with the creation of what is now known as the University of North Carolina, 16 or 17 campuses, 16 at its creation. And he said the people believe that President Friday created this system. Well, I guess that's true in the sense that you took what was put on your plate, even though you had, I would just say, fought against it. How do you describe that situation, and what are the leadership lessons that you learned and that those of us who follow along with you could learn?
Well, D.G., I had one rule that I tried to follow religiously. I recognized and understood that the University of North Carolina is a public institution. It belongs to the people, and in that context is a part of the political process of the state. But on the other hand, the University of North Carolina should never get involved in partisan politics. And even if somebody as close as Terry Sanford and I were together, I never walked across that line, nor did he. And the only real fuss we ever had was the time I felt he was doing it, and I had to tell him. But you do things because of the power of the university itself in the life of the people. Edward Kidder Graham was right, D.G., the borders of the University of North Carolina are really coterminous with the borders of the state. It does three great things and does them very well. You can't be around here and not hear names like O.B. Hardison, who Time magazine called one of the great teachers of the year. He was chosen as one of the teachers of the country. Or Bunny Boyd, or Preston Epps, or Harry Russell, or William Aycock in the law school. You can go on and on. In research, here we sit with a Nobel laureate. Nobody else in this region can claim that. His work was originally here. So in research, yes, it holds its own.
Let me interrupt you just a little bit, and this is unfair because what you're saying is so true, but here's the question that's been haunting me since I reviewed that challenging time back in the early 1970s when all the 4-year institutions were brought under the University of North Carolina. And as I read that history, it seemed that the university board, that is the what was then the 6-campus University of North Carolina, felt that a coming together under a single board was risky, and that the people of North Carolina could be better served by holding the University of North Carolina as it was then constructed as a separate entity. So the question I wanted to ask is, you took the position of your board at that point. Now you've got the benefit of a 16-17 campus university that you helped put in order. Would North Carolina have been better if the forces of the old board had won and the university had concentrated on those 6 campuses?
Well, back in the 1970s, we were working toward doing what ultimately had to be done. The difficulty at the time was that politics got in it. And that's the reason why I wanted to state that we were always recognizing that we're a public, therefore political institution, but we're never in partisan politics. Partisan politics got into this. There's where I stepped back. I said, no, I'm not going to engage in that. I haven't. That's not the way the university should act. And it worked itself out. It was an unhappy time in part, but whether or not we did the right thing or not, negatively, we could not go on with what we had. It was producing so much strife and tension that nothing was happening of any value. So everybody looked around the countryside. You saw what California had done. There were 9 campuses. You looked at Michigan, there were 5 campuses. What did the really great universities in the country do? And that's what we were headed toward. So this was the decision. Now, I think the great problem now is one of watching size. There is a point at which being too big is dangerous. And I, for example, worry about the size of NC State and Chapel Hill. I think we're getting to the point where you don't really have the college experience. Mm-hmm. You become a person that moves in this building and that building, and that's it. Maybe that's inevitable, but I would like to think that what we tried to do, where you can move to different directions and different campuses, like the University of North Carolina at Asheville, recognized all over as a great liberal arts 4-year institution.
Well, this leads me to probably my last question, because time's flown visiting with you. But we're looking for a new president who would be your successor, 3 in between. And what will you hope for from the new president of the university in terms of the kinds of things he or she would be doing that you would hope that the new president will turn his or her attention to?
Well, you know, look at what has happened. The whole process 70, 80 years ago started with Frank Graham. There was a native-born, native-raised president. Then we came to Gordon Gray, then myself, then Molly Broad, then Dick Spangler, now Erskine Bowles, and all except one instance. We stayed within the family, so to speak. Now, that sounds paternalistic, but no. Today, the volatility of what we have in public life, it's hard to take 3-4 years to train somebody to be a president once you come into the system. So, point number one, if all things are otherwise are equal, I'm for the native Heath. You have to cut that out. and there's nothing wrong with that. Frank Graham was an international figure. Gordon Gray was the same way. Each of us has done a lived a different role and tried to contribute a different perspective, but always being very mindful of the fundamental rule, and that is that the university is what it is to the state. It's the greatest asset North Carolina has. It's a beloved enterprise.
Any warnings for the new president? What are your warnings?
That we will make cost too great a factor and not keep the university open. And we're dangerously close to that with this $750 tuition raise this time. I would watch that. Secondly, always watch the political intrusion. People want to tamper with the university. That speaker ban law is the best illustration of that. Thirdly, bigness. Now, how do you accommodate that? I think what we've done with the alliances of degree programming with the community colleges is wonderful. We got to do more of that. But the immediate problem, DG, is expense. We're pricing the university out of the reach of a lot of people. And that, to me, is a very dangerous thing.
I wish we had more time. You've been very generous in sharing some of your thoughts and ideas and memories with us, and I'll just be the last person to say congratulations on 90 great years. Thank you, President Friday.
Thank you, DG, and especially am I grateful for your friendship.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been DG Martin with Who's Talking, our guest William Friday. I'll be right back here sometime soon.